Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to our 15th annual Writers Symposium by the Sea at Point Loma Nazarene University. I'm Dean Nelson on the journalism faculty at the university, and it's our great honor to have Bill McKibben with us, a great environmental writer who has been a significant voice in understanding how the world works and where it's going. He's written 12 books. His next one is about to come out in just a matter of days. Bill McKibben, it's a wonderful pleasure to have you with us on our campus.
Very, very good to be here.
No, I'm so intrigued by your background. Here, you went to Harvard. You were the editor, or at least a participant in the newspaper there, the Crimson, and you go right from your college newspaper to the New Yorker. Really? Who gets to do that?
It was a fluke for ways that I'll explain, reasons I'll explain. But when I was a junior, I got a call at the Crimson one day, a voice on the other end of the phone saying, "This is William Shawn, the editor of The New Yorker, the 40 years veteran editor of The New Yorker, probably greatest magazine editor of American history. And say, would you like to come work for us when you get out of school?" And so, of course, I knew that it was people at the Lampoon calling to make fun of me.
Mm-hmm.
So I said,
it was a total prank.
Bad word beginning with an F-U, and slammed down the phone. And 6 months later, the same voice appeared on the other end of the phone saying the same thing. So this time I thought, maybe I was a little hasty. And the measure of what a gentleman Mr. Shawn was, and a gentleman of the old school indeed he was that we then worked together very closely for 5 or 6 years, his last 5 or 6 years at the magazine and my time there, without ever once either of us mentioning how our relationship had begun.
So you worked for the New Yorker. You wrote the Talk of the Town. And moved into,
which in those days was a very different animal. Not only was I writing anonymously, which I greatly enjoyed, but the one rule of thumb for Talk of the Town in those days was that it couldn't be about anybody famous. It couldn't have anything to do with anybody in the news or famous or celebrity or anything. So it was great fun.
Yeah.
I was all over New York doing all kinds of things.
So then you move into environmental writing. You're writing for Harper's, The Atlantic, Outside, Rolling Stone, any number of places in addition to your work with The New Yorker, and you just become this giant in environment writing.
There's more story to it, as there often is, than that. I wasn't writing for those places at the same time because I quit the New Yorker the day they fired Cy Newhouse. Bought the New Yorker, big corporation, bought the New Yorker, and they essentially fired Mr. Shawn. And I quit. At the time, it seemed a matter of high principle. But in retrospect, I think it was... I think I must have realized at some point in some part of my 27-year-old psyche that this was actually a really good excuse to leave what could have been a kind of velvet prison, a wonderful place to write. So I moved, not only left New Yorker, I moved just to the Adirondack Mountains, to the great wilderness of the American East, sort of out of the middle of the city into the middle of the woods. And that's really when my writing started to take a very different turn.
Mm-hmm. I remember the first book of yours I ever read was The Age of Missing Information. And I was reading this and I just thought, A, it was just a beautiful book, but B, it was just such a great idea. You take 24 hours of cable television, 80 channels, is that what?
100 channels.
100 channels. 24 hours, and you record it, So you've got 2,400 hours of television to watch. So you watch that, and then you spend 24 hours on the top of a mountain. Okay, so what did 2,400 hours of television teach you? And what did 24 hours on top of the mountain teach you?
Well, there's a lot of stories in the book, a lot of things in the book. I mean, it's a very interesting project to kind of, on one level, it was a very horrible project, I must say.
The mountain couldn't have been that bad.
A year of watching television every day, all day long as your job is just about as much fun as it sounds like. And one of the best results was that we were able then to get rid of the TV without feeling like intellectual snob. You know, I'd given it its due. There were a lot of lessons that came through, and the book is filled with kind of observations about time and sufficiency and things. But if you boil down everything that came through that coaxial cable for that 24-hour period, sort of day in the life of the information age, I think the most powerful message that came through all the time, and it's really the message of a consumer society of which TV was the most profound anchor, the message is, you know, you're the most important thing on Earth. You're the center of the universe. This bud's for you, you know? And which is a... We've come to describe this idea as human nature, okay? After 50 or 60 years of conditioning in a highly consumer society. And anytime anybody proposes anything that sounds at all contrary to that, that would be impossible. That goes against human nature. Clearly, it's a part of your nature, right? This sort of selfish, self-absorbed part. But for most of human history, other things have been at the center of people's idea, their identity, you know, their relationship with the natural world, with God, with each other, with the community, the tribe, have been how people define themselves. And so it was very interesting to think about our culture as one in which most of the taboos and limitations that come with being part of something larger than you have now been effectively cast aside, and we've been taught to think of ourselves in units of one very powerfully. And of course, when you're outside, no great news here. I mean, the kind of overwhelming feeling is precisely the opposite. You're small, and everything else is large, you know, but in a nice way. In a beautiful way. Everything seems sufficient. You don't sit by the pond and think, boy, that pond would be better if there were more rocks in it, you know, or something. It's just, there it is, you know. So it was probably a good thing to have done.
You know, I want to talk about End of Nature, the book you wrote, because more than 20 years ago, you started saying things about climate change and global warming. And I don't recall seeing many other people than you talking about that in the popular media. And now, it just seems in the last 5 or 6 years, it seems like it's become a thing. Is that fairly gratifying and from your perspective to say, oh, people are finally starting to pay attention to this?
It would have been nice had it happened rather more quickly. I was 27 when I wrote The End of Nature, and my view as a 27-year-old would be that it was going to be that the way that change would happen would be I would write a book, people would read about it, and then we would do what we needed to do to deal with the biggest problem that we had faced. And, you know, in fact, actually a lot of people read it. It was in, you know, 24 languages or something and on all the bestseller lists, but oddly enough, it didn't actually change the entire trajectory of the world's economic system.
A Harvard guy would think that way, wouldn't he?
Pretty much.
You know, you've been accused of being just this doom and gloom guy for more than 20 years, and there's a whole groundswell of folks who say, all this stuff that you cite, it's just a, in fact, I think the quote is, the biggest hoax, the global warming, the biggest hoax on the public. I mean, and they look back at to like 1973, that limits to growth report, you know, that looked like the end of the world, and that didn't turn out to be true. It's just all one big political...
The odd part, you know, the odd part is it didn't... I just went back and reread all the limits to growth stuff for this new book of mine that's coming out in a week or two. It's amazing to go back and read that set of reports and see, in fact, how very close to the mark they were. A team of Australian academics just put out a long paper examining all the assumptions that the limits to growth people had made about what was going to happen, and they were unbelievably prescient. If you read, I have a piece in the current issue of Scientific American, and it accompanies a piece by a number of scientists talking not only about carbon in the atmosphere, but about eight other tipping points, nitrogen systems, you know, long list of things. And in each of them, we're either over or very, very near what seem to be the profound tipping points. With carbon, we've clearly got way too much in the atmosphere already.
So where do these people come out that say, it's just a political hoax?
Well, let's think about it. Most Americans, polling shows, are very clear that climate change is happening and real. And if most Americans think that way, the overwhelming majority of people in other parts of the world do so. I mean, I was in Copenhagen when Senator Imhoff, the source of your quote about this is the biggest hoax we've ever seen, Senator from Oklahoma, came over to Copenhagen to do his shtick, and he had a press conference. And it was actually quite funny because most of the press there was European. And the first four or five questions that he got from European reporters were some variant on, you know, what are you smoking? And he just sort of packed up and left after a while because he wasn't getting the, you know, respect that his theories normally get in our press, which loves, you know, finding conflict where there isn't any. The fossil fuel industry is the single most profitable industry on the planet. ExxonMobil made more money last year than any company in the history of money. Okay, there are an extraordinarily large number of reasons, 40 billion in that case, why you'd resist the notion that we're going to have to get off fossil fuel. And now it's become an article of, you know, a piece of the true cross for a kind of right-wing Tea Party, whatever, strata in this society, not because there's any science to indicate that climate change isn't real.
You know, something flipped with you. You went from being kind of a journalist to an activist. And I'd like you to describe the 350 organization. And you went from being a guy who wrote about it to the guy who's trying to get everybody to change the way they live. Did that have anything to do with? Didn't you get really sick on one of your trips? Didn't you get dengue fever? And are those two things related? Where you did this shift?
I think at some level, everybody who writes about things like this is greatly in the hope that it will cause change. And as I said, I've had more time than most people to figure out that writing alone isn't going to cause the kind of change that we need, perhaps. Since I was once young when I started all this work. I can tell, I suppose, a reasonable story that will make that, I went to Bangladesh, and they're having their first big outbreak of dengue, which is a mosquito-borne disease whose incidence is up about 200% in the last decade across Asia and South America because mosquitoes profoundly dig the warm, wet world that we're building for them. And there were lots of people dying all over Dhaka. I mean, Bangladesh is a great place, a beautiful, green, fertile, wonderful country that's going to be completely wrecked. The Bay of Bengal is rising, salt already pushing up into, you know, the glaciers at the head of the Ganges and the Brahmaputra are beginning to dwindle, on and on and on. But this was acute, not chronic. I was spending a lot of time in the slums, so I eventually got bit by the wrong mosquito. I got sick. I remember going to the hospital, and there was a ward bigger than the room we're in now, and just people on cots sitting there shivering from this. I highly recommend not getting dengue. And I was shivering, but mostly I was just sitting there thinking, this is unbelievably unfair. And there's 140 or 50 million people in Bangladesh, so half the U.S. population. But when the UN tries to measure how much carbon each nation emits into the atmosphere, you can't even get a number for Bangladesh. It's a rounding error in the calculations. People take bicycle rickshaws. Not that many people are connected to the grid, on and on and on. The 4% of people who live in this country produce 25% of the world's CO2. I mean, if you want to do kind of first cut moral mathematics, if there's 100 beds in that hospital in Dhaka, 25 of them are on us, you know. So having seen that and things like it, it made it harder to shut up or easier to try to figure out something to do beyond writing and speaking. And so that's probably 4 or 5 years ago when I started trying to learn how to organize. Because it became very clear to me that what we were missing with the reason we weren't getting any action on climate change was that there wasn't any movement about it. We had Al Gore and we had scientists and policy people and economists. We had the kind of superstructure of a movement, but we'd never managed to bother to build the movement that went with it, that would give it any kind of political heft or power. Completely trial by error. I mean, we started trying to figure out how to do this. We started in Vermont, where started very cluelessly. I had no idea. I called up a few of my writer friends in Vermont and said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to go up to Burlington, which is our main city, has about 50,000 people, so it's not so main a city, but it's as good as we got. And we're going to sit in on the steps of the federal building, and we'll be arrested, and there'll be a little story in the paper, and we will have done something. And, you know, the writers is clueless. Oh, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's do that. What a good plan.
That'll get the carbon out of the air.
Somebody called up to the police and said, what'll happen if we do this? And the police said, nothing will happen. Stay there as long as you want, you know. So we organized, I started sending out emails, said we're going to go for a walk. And a couple weeks later, we left from Robert Frost's old summer writing cabin up in the Green Mountains, because he's kind of our patron saint, you know, and because we thought that most cliched of all high school English class poems about the road not taken was sort of apropos, you know. And off we walked for 5 days. We'd sleep in farm fields at night. I'm a Methodist Sunday school teacher, so I called up all the kind of Methodist mafia, and we had potluck supper. I mean, Methodists very good at potlucks. That's kind of our main sacrament. And we got to Burlington, and there were 1,000 people walking. Now, you know, we're in a big, sophisticated, cosmopolitan place. In Vermont, 1,000 people is a lot. I mean, except for University of Vermont hockey games, that's as many people as there ever are in one place at one time. And got all our congressmen and people running for Senate and stuff. They all come down to meet with us, and they all sign this raggedy piece of cardboard we've been carrying that says, if I'm elected, I'll work to cut carbon emissions 80% by 2050, which was at the time a very radical idea endorsed only by scientists, not by politicians. But they all signed, including the Republicans. The woman who was running for Congress on the GOP ticket, who almost won, she'd said 2 months before what too many politicians have said, I'm not sure global warming is real. More research needs to be done. Well, come to find out, the more research that needed to be done was on the question, how many people will walk across Vermont and ask me to change my mind? And empirically, 1,000 was sufficient, you know? So that was good. I mean, it was a good thing. The bad thing was to open the paper and read this story the next day that said this 1,000 people was probably the largest demonstration about climate change that had yet taken place in the U.S. This was 2006. And that was sort of the moment. So we don't have a movement. We have to get one. Can we do it? We decided to try. We, meaning me and six undergraduates at Middlebury College, which is a place about the same size as Point Loma Nazarene, you know, and we didn't have any money. But we started sending out emails to people saying, April 2007, I think April 14th, will you organize something like this where you are? And we hoped maybe we'd organize 100 of these things, which would have been 100 more than there had been. Instead, it turned out there were people all over the U.S. who had already changed their light bulbs, already figured out that changing their light bulbs was not actually going to solve climate change, were kind of in that difficult place of wanting to take action, but also feeling that this was simply too big for any action that they took to have any effect. And so the prospect of doing something together with a lot of other people was very nice. And that day in 2007, we managed to have 1,400 simultaneous rallies in all 50 states. And the next 3 days later, both Clinton and Obama, then running for president, endorsed this 80% by 2050 target, you know, which made us feel, I think smug would be the technical term for what we felt. The only problem was that 6 weeks later, in the summer of 2007, was when the Arctic began very rapidly to melt. And by the time it was done melting, it was clear that our targets were out of date, that we needed action much sooner than 2050, and it was clear we were going to have to try to organize around the world, which is when we started this 350.org thing, which is a whole other long story.
I do want to just tell them what 350 means, 350, and I want to move on.
Well, 350 is, in January of 2008, Jim Hansen and his team at NASA, the sort of foremost climatologists in the world, put out a paper saying, we now know enough between the paleoclimatic data that we have and real-time observation of phenomenon like the Arctic ice melt to tell where the red line is. And the red line is at 350 parts per million CO2. Any value for carbon in the atmosphere greater than that, they said, was not, how did they put it in this? This is in a peer-reviewed paper. Said was not compatible with the planet on which civilization developed and to which life on Earth is adapted. Pretty strong language. Stronger still when you realize that we're well past it already. 390 parts per million CO2. Rising by about 2 parts per million per year. That's why the Arctic is melting. That's why Australia is on fire. That's, you know, down the list. And that's why we have to actually change much faster and much more dramatically than will be convenient or pleasant or politically easy or anything else. And it's why we then launched this global campaign using that fairly obscure scientific data point as the rallying cry. I'll show some pictures tomorrow of the first set of results, which came last October when we held the same group of students, now graduated from Middlebury, sort of set out in 18 months to organize the planet. There were 7 of them, which is good because there are 7 continents. The one who got the Antarctic also got the internet because that's kind of its own continent. And we did our job. We found people all over the world who cared deeply. And on last October 24th, we managed to have simultaneously 5,200 demonstrations in 181 countries. CNN said it was the most widespread day of political action in the planet's history. It was owned Google News for 36 hours. It was on the front page of every newspaper in the planet almost the next day. And it meant that when we got to Copenhagen, there were 117 nations that endorsed this quite radical target, which was unbelievable. Given that it was an entirely citizens kind of grassroots movement that in 18 months had done this. The only problem was it was the wrong 117. It was the poor and vulnerable nations of the planet, and we are not yet convinced the powerful and deeply addicted nations of the planet to do what needs doing. So on we go. And I hope you'll circle October 10th on your calendar for this year, because we're going to have something slightly different. Instead of sort of global political rallies, we're going to have a global work party. And in thousands of communities, people will be doing very practical things, putting solar panels on roofs, insulating homes, digging community gardens, laying out bike paths, whatever it is. Not because we think we're going to solve this problem one project at a time. We're not. We're only going to solve it if and when we get serious national and international legislation that puts a price on carbon. Okay? But projects like this will, of course, help in local communities. More to the point, they'll allow us to say to our putative leaders, would you guys get to work? I mean, we're doing the work. If we can get up on the roof of the school and put in the solar panel, surely you can get up on the floor of the Senate and do your work that you're paid to do, which is pass legislation about important things, you know? Get to work. That's the message we've somehow got to get across, so we're going to do it in the most direct way that we can think of on October 10th, and I hope you all join us in
cool.
helping do that.
In conclusion, I'm going to ask you to do something.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you to read.
Uh-oh.
I'm going to ask you to read, starting at the line I've got marked there. Okay, this is the last several lines from The Age of Missing Information, written 20 years ago, almost. Just start there.
This must be, let me look and just see what this is.
You know, you might better check the front of it, make sure it's yours.
Yeah, no, it's mine. It's been a long time since I've seen this book. But this was just kind of, at the end of this, there was just kind of some stream of consciousness. I was just sort of reporting what was on all these channels at one point in the morning. So I guess this is what this is.
Read it all the way to the end.
The financial markets, according to ABC, are waiting for the new unemployment figures. It all has to do with how those new unemployment numbers show up. Too many new jobs could tip the Fed into raising interest rates. Car sales rose a cheerful 4.1% in the first 10 days of April, but business travel to St. Louis will be delayed 1 hour and 5 minutes due to fog. The traffic copter notes that someone on the shoulder of Muddy Branch Road is changing his tire. On country music television, a singer laments that pretty girls are a dime a dozen and I only got a nickel to my name. Some oldsters are sitting on a sofa being interviewed for a plumbing ad. When I was a girl, water didn't come to us. We went to water. We had a well and we pumped her. Colors, I don't remember any. Styles, we had styles of dresses, not faucets. On Now You're Cooking, a lady is making pigs in a blanket with the super snacker. We have a pact in our house. The first one up plugs in the super snacker. And on the pond, the duck is just swimming back and forth, his chest pushing out a wedge of ripples that catch the early rays of the sun.
Bill McKibben, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.